There's nobody in this administration starry-eyed about the prospects of North Korea actually denuclearizing.
Dialogue is traded between North Korea and the United States. It's Tuesday, August 7th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Be sure to join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, could Rohingya refugees move to an island? Finding asylum in the United States can be difficult. Implant medications, using straw to fuel your car. It's all on today's VOA Asia. North Korean state media Monday accused the United States of acting opposite to its pledge to improve ties, describing outrageous arguments that it won't ease sanctions until denuclearization is completed, and reinforcing sanctions to raise its negotiating power. The ruling Workers' Party newspaper, Rodong Simun, said the North had taken practical measures, including a moratorium on nuclear and missile testing, the dismantling of a nuclear site, and a return of remains of American service personnel killed in the Korean War. A similar message was delivered at an Asian security forum in Singapore by North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho, who took aim at what he called America's alarming insistence on denuclearization. However, he said the North stood firm in its determination and commitment to implement a June agreement with the U.S. in June. On Fox News, White House National Security Advisor John Bolton reacted to signs the North continues to advance its nuclear and missile programs.
There's nobody in this administration starry-eyed about the prospects of North Korea actually denuclearizing. But I think what's going on now is that the president is giving Kim Jong-un a master class in how to hold a door open for somebody. And if the North Koreans can't figure out how to walk through it, even the president's fiercest critics will not be able to say it's because he didn't open it wide enough. We're going to have to see performance from the North Koreans. There's no question about it.
Bolton said Kim Jong-un promised South Korea's President Moon Jae-in in April he would denuclearize within a year. He said the United States is waiting to see if that strategic decision has been made. Tufts University Korean Studies Assistant Professor Sung-Yoon Lee tells VOA's Victor Beatty Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had nothing to gain from North Korea at last week's Asian Security Forum.
The North Korean representative, Foreign Minister Ri, was bound to play hardball, blaming the U.S., U.S. hostility, U.S. sanctions, U.S. noncompliance, when North Korea purportedly has made many concessions, which are really no concessions. For example, returning 55 alleged remains of U.S. war dead, U.S. soldiers, fully 65 years later, 65 years after they should have, and recently shutting down a nuclear testing site, as North Korea did in May, and apparently now shutting down one missile launch pad. But these gestures have nothing to do with the reality that North Korea has a viable, functional nuclear ballistic missile arsenal. So these are just gestures, smoke screens, and North Korea was bound to play on these so-called concessions to make the point that the U.S. needs to do more. And that fake message or disingenuous message would have resonated in a multilateral forum like the ASEAN Regional Forum. Why? Because you have China, you have Russia that support North Korea, you have South Korea that is very much keen on appeasing North Korea at the moment. You even have Japan that is quite nervous about being marginalized, about being isolated, so is actually making an effort of its own to reach out to Kim Jong-un for a summit meeting. So Mike Pompeo was, in a way, somewhat isolated. And whatever he said, even if they're all valid, and they are, he mentioned how Russia was violating UN Security Council resolutions, prohibiting hiring North Korean laborers to work in Russia. He mentioned how some states were violating UN sanctions. All these are valid admonitions, but they would have had minimum impact in a multilateral forum like ARF.
National Security Advisor John Bolton, in public remarks on U.S. television Sunday, said the point may well come when the U.S. concludes North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is not serious about his promises to denuclearize. He said the president is giving Mr. Kim a master class in how to hold a door open for somebody. He said if the North Koreans can't figure out how to walk through, even the president's fiercest critics will not be able to say it's because he didn't open it wide enough.
Well, John Bolton is doing his best, and I'm sure he himself has grave misgivings about the U.S. approach in recent months with summit diplomacy and with President Trump's statements that the nuclear threat is over, that he trusts Chairman Kim, and so on. The common fallacy here is that both proponents of engagement and diplomacy discount the very cold reality that just returning to talks and giving North Korea more time and money with which to advance and perhaps even perfect its lethal nuclear and missile capability.
That risk, he said, involves wasting time, trusting the North Korean leader, and engaging in a lengthy dialogue, all while permitting improper sanctions enforcement. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll currently find right now on VOAnews.com. China lashes out as retaliatory moves fail to stop Trump trade actions. Lao Dam breach highlights fears over massive projects. Deadly quake kills 98 on Indonesian resort island. Taiwan's Kinmen Island begins importing water from China. Admiral to VOA, U.S. consistency counters Chinese aggression in South China Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A human rights group is urging Bangladesh to reconsider its plans to move Rohingya refugees to a small uninhabited island. Human Rights Watch said in a report issued Monday that the mangrove and grass island of Basanchar has been formed only in the last 20 years by silt from Bangladesh's Meghna River. In the 68-page report, Bangladesh is not my country, the plight of Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, experts predict that Basanchar could become completely submerged in the event of a strong cyclone during a high tide. Phil Robertson is deputy director of the Human Rights Watch Asia Division. He spoke from Bangkok via Skype with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
Well, the big problem with Basanchar, which is the name of the island, it's only 20 years old. It is arisen from silt from the river, the Meghna River. And in fact, when you look at it, it's still in shifting form. It has not really settled. And so what has happened is they're saying, okay, we're going to move the people there. But it's so remote that it would essentially be a one-way ticket there. It would be very difficult for the authorities to guarantee freedom of movement for people to leave again. It would be very difficult to resupply. And there's serious concerns that if a typhoon hit that area, and the area is typhoon prone, that it would be completely submerged. Recently, we have also heard that, you know, they built a protective wall around it to keep the ocean out. But we understand that with the monsoon rains, that area inside that protective wall have sort of filled up like a swimming pool. So I think there's some very, very serious problems with moving people there, aside from the fact that people don't want to move that far away from the Myanmar border and, frankly, have not really been consulted in any meaningful way about whether they would be willing to move there.
How did this come about? How was it? Didn't the Bangladesh government have any discussions with human rights organizations or NGOs or anything about this? And then there's the issue of them feeling like they're in prison on this island.
Well, that's what it would be, actually. It would be a sort of a prison-like experience because the Bangladesh authorities have said the only way to get off the island would be to return to Burma. And if you know, that would make it essentially an immigration detention center. You're holding people there until they agree to go back. This whole thing came up a number of years ago. We don't know the absolute origin of it, but we do know that this has been embraced by the Bangladesh Navy as an important project. They persuaded the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, that this was a good idea. And it has been had a life of its own. I mean, it, literally, when it first came up, people thought they were kidding. But then they started pitching this to various different donors. They went around to the UN agencies. No one was interested. They started talking to the Gulf states, you know, about trying to pony up some money. And now they've decided to go on their own with the support of the Chinese. And this is now where we are. I think that the discussion now is that there's supposed to be a technical team from the UN agencies to go take a look. But the government of Bangladesh has been delaying that because I think they have some technical problems. I think that they have built a bathtub perhaps on that island that, you know, the wall is keeping the water in as well as keeping the water out. And I don't know how they're going to solve that problem, but it's certainly not a place to move 100,000 refugees.
Is there any place to move 100,000 refugees in that area, except maybe back to Burma, which is quite questionable, as I'm sure everyone understands why? And why do they have to move from where they are now?
Well, the problem right now in in the Cox's Bazar mega camp is many of these areas are prone to landslides. And they're very, very heavily congested. So the idea is to try to find other land to place these people. We've actually suggested that there are some plots of land right adjacent to the camp that actually could be used. The government of Bangladesh has been very reluctant to agree to that because they say that they would encroach other people's land or cause problems, you know. And I think there's also a political dimension here that the Bangladesh government doesn't want to be seen as giving too much to refugees because, you know, they're now in a process of moving towards elections that are scheduled to be held in January 2019. And the beef is always that the Bangladesh people feel like, you know, you're giving everything to refugees when you're not giving things to us, a sort of beggar thy neighbor approach. And the government of Bangladesh is very sensitive to that. So this is where this Basan Char idea came up, that, you know, this is land that no one is using. It's completely uninhabited, and therefore, what a great place to put refugees. But, you know, it's not safe. It's not – wouldn't be a voluntary movement there. And I think that ultimately it would train the spotlight of the global community away from Myanmar, which, of course, created this problem by committing crimes against humanity against these Rohingya, and on Bangladesh, which – till now has basically received a great deal of praise for leaving the borders open and allowing the Rohingya to come into the country and seek refuge.
What can you do about this, if anything?
Well, I think we try to keep working on the Bangladesh government and the UN agencies to try to persuade them that this is not a good idea. We point out alternatives. We try to educate refugees about, you know, what is being proposed here so that they're involved in the conversation. And I think that ultimately, you know, we have to get the donors involved. You know, the problem is, frankly, that many things right now in terms of the overall UN appeal for the refugees in that mega camp are underfunded. So I think the, you know, donors need to be coming in and being much more engaged in terms of not only providing support for the existing camp, but then also making sure that money is not diverted away from the mega camp to this very bad experiment at Basan Char.
Phil, thanks as always. I really appreciate it.
Ira, happy to help.
In August 2017, Myanmar's military launched a major counteroffensive in Rakhine State in response to attacks on state security posts by Rohingya militants. Nearly 700,000 Rohingyas fled across the border into Bangladesh as security forces carried out numerous human rights abuses, including murder, rape, and arson, in a siege both the United Nations and the United States described as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Happening now in Asia, a new museum in Yangon, Myanmar, has been built as the country marks the 30th anniversary of its 1988 democracy movement. The museum is one of the only places in Myanmar where visitors can learn what inmates endured under military rule in the years following the movement. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad, as always, to have you with us today on VOA Asia. People come to immigrate to the United States for many reasons, one of which is seeking shelter from persecution or other harm. those who make asylum claims after coming to the U.S. illegally are much more likely to be turned down than granted asylum. Out of 120,000-plus asylum cases by illegal entrants in 2017, only about 7,000 were granted, according to the Justice Department. Surio, a 64-year-old man from Mexico, is one of the lucky ones. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports on his story as an illustration of an overburdened system.
Long lines are now common at the U.S.-Mexico border, where immigrants queue up at official border posts to enter the U.S. legally and usually claim asylum. If they do it legally, they have a much better chance of being granted asylum. Those who cross illegally and request asylum are less than half as likely to get it, according to 2016 government statistics. Sergio, who came illegally from Mexico, is one of the lucky ones.
I came to the United States in 1992 because there was not a lot of work down there.
Under the Trump administration's strict enforcement procedures, he was targeted for deportation after being arrested for drunkenness in May of last year. Jailed near Los Angeles, he says a guard insulted him early in his 9 months in detention.
He said, "You're a prisoner." I said, "No, I'm not a prisoner. I'm in detention for immigration. I haven't committed any crimes."
Sergio says his relationship with the guards deteriorated from there. His lawyer, who works for Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project, a program of Catholic charities, applied for asylum for his client, who suffered from mental illness.
He did have some medical treatment in detention, but it was clearly very inadequate. He ended up attempting suicide a month before he was released. So I think that's a sign that his medication wasn't right. He wasn't getting adequate care while he was detained.
A judge agreed that Sergio would not get adequate care if he returned to Mexico. He was granted asylum in February. Sergio was granted asylum relatively quickly, but U.S. officials say the system is being slowed by a growing number of claims. Sergio feels relieved that his case is resolved, but is still waiting for a visa.
Frustrated. I'm frustrated because I'm staying at a shelter.
Free but in temporary housing, he is ready for a new chapter to begin. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Coming up, a new way to take medicine. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, a journalists association in Hong Kong has announced it will defy the Chinese government and give a planned speech advocating independence from China. Authorities have increasingly been cracking down on free speech advocates in Hong Kong. You may freely visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, remembering to take medications can be challenging for some people. But one day, an implant may replace medications that need to be taken orally in certain cases. One lab in Houston is developing refillable implants placed under the skin to potentially deliver life-saving medicine at a low cost for various diseases. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from the Houston Methodist Research Institute.
Researchers at this lab are developing a way to deliver drugs to patients through a small implant that doesn't require a pumping mechanism.
These implants are inserted under the skin of patients and then deliver the drugs for extended period of time, for months and potentially years, and they continue releasing the drug until the drug is completely gone.
Medication is released through membranes with nanochannels inside different implants like these.
They end up acting like glands, are like artificial glands inside of the body. They do the things that the glands in the body normally do, secrete necessary molecules when they are needed.
The nanochannel delivery system can provide either a steady and constant dose of a drug or one that can be controlled remotely.
We decided to invent and develop the system that can be remotely controlled. So via a phone or via a remote control, via Bluetooth, you can modulate the drug administration over time so that you can increase it, decrease it, suspend it.
These implants are different sizes and can deliver drugs for conditions like high blood pressure and rheumatoid arthritis, for HIV prevention, even for cancer.
So what we have envisioned is a device, a tiny little device, is the size of a grain of rice, that can be inserted via a needle, just simple needle, inside of a tumor mass and deliver immunotherapy straight inside of the tumor.
Another possibility is to use the implant to deliver a drug that fights obesity by helping patients lose fat without changing their diets. NASA is also conducting research on the implants with nanotechnology to help solve a problem astronauts experience.
Once they go in space, they tend to lose muscle and as well as bone density unless they work out. So we have focused on a specific medication trying to prevent muscle atrophy from occurring. And we have sent animals in space, rodents, and we tested this implant for a period of about 2 months. We are now in the process of analyzing the all the samples and the data.
Using the implant for HIV prevention could enter the clinical trial phase within 3 years. It may take several more years before other applications of the implant are tested on humans as research continues. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
This news from VOA Asia. Hiroshima has marked the 73rd anniversary of the atomic bombing in World War II with a ceremony to remember those who died and a call for the elimination of nuclear weapons. The mayor of Hiroshima warned that a rising tide of nationalism is threatening world peace. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a Pakistani engineer has designed a system to help developing countries avoid fuel imports by making ethanol with the millions of tons of straw that are wasted each year. VOA's Faith Lapidus powers the rest of the story.
Harvesting barley by hand in Sindh province will not make this farmer rich, but there is money to be made from the byproducts of his labor. After threshing the stalks to separate the grain from Pakistan's annual wheat harvest, what's left is about 50 million tons of straw. Syed Hussein Abed sees that straw as an untapped source of fuel.
What we're doing is we take straw from the farmers at very good rates, and then we turn it into ethanol by using a five-step process. We break down the straw, utilize the sugars within the straw, ferment it, and then distill it. Right now, all of the sugar is hidden behind cell walls, which is why straw has zero nutritional value. The chemical processes expose that sugar out, which can then be fermented like all other alcohols and then get ethanol out of it.
Called Albar, the system foresees an income stream from the straw, along with the development of hybrid vehicles and stoves to use the fuel.
Since you're making fuel and it's a company that makes fuel and sells it, there's no point in having a fuel source if there's nothing that uses it. So side by side, I'm also developing hybrid vehicles that utilize ethanol and combined with solar energy, which is very prominent in Pakistan as well.
Pakistan spends some $20 billion annually to import fuel from other countries. Aside from the potential savings, Abid says the system also helps the environment.
Because you're making the fuel within your region, you're not importing any more carbon from anywhere. So it protects you from financial as well as environmental hazards, because then the carbon itself, which is being released into the air, gets sucked up by the plants again. And then the process continues. So you're not generating any more carbon in that region.
Abid recently completed his joint master's degree in innovation design engineering at Imperial College London and the Royal College of Art. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Many of you listen via the radio around Asia, including U-Radio of Hatay University, FM 101.25, Hatay University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone who tuned in there today. And the time you've all been waiting for, we'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, you know her, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.